Welcome to Our Christian Heritage. I'm Randy Melcher, and we traveled to Oklahoma today to talk to Vicki Beller. Her late husband wrote the book America in Crimson Red, a look at some of the lesser-known figures in American history, Christians who sacrificed many of them with their lives to ensure that we could have the religious freedom that we take for granted. Let's talk to Vicki Beller today on Our Christian Heritage. Shortly after I got married, my wife gave me this book and said, "You've got to read this." I was a little worried because it was a very thick book, but as soon as I started opening it, I couldn't put it down. This is amazing work done by your late husband, James Beller. Who was your husband? Why was he ever interested in Baptist church history?
Well, he was born, grew up in St. Louis, and he his family was Catholic. That did not go very often, but was Catholic. And he, at 17, he was at Fox High School, lived in Arnold, Missouri. And he went to Fox High School. He was all-conference. He was football captain. He was voted most likely to succeed. He was pretty active in school. And then at home, when he was home, he would had different jobs around the house. Again, he's 17 and a half. And on Thursday, his dad would get his check and on for the week, and his mom would go out to the grocery store. And so when she got home on Friday, when she went out to the grocery store, he would go out and get the groceries and bring them in. Well, this one particular Friday, he went out to get the groceries, and he opened the door, and he looked in, on the seat, and there was something sitting on the seat. And it was a little pamphlet called This Was Your Life. And he looked at it, and at the bottom of the pages, he kind of ruffled through it a little bit, and at the bottom of the pages, it said Rev and Rome. And he thought, you know what, this is Bible. This has got to be good. So he brought in the groceries and went back to his room, and he sat down, and he read through it, and he read intently, and looked at it, and he was really taking it all in until the last page or close to the end where the angel throws the man into hell because they've not trusted Christ. And he read that, and he said, "That's God wouldn't do that. This is not true." And he took the track, and he ripped it. He told me he ripped it into a million pieces. He was so mad, and he threw it in the trash. And it went on. He felt pretty good about it. He ripped it apart. And so the week progressed, and again, keep going. Thursday, his dad gets his check. Friday, his mom goes to the grocery store. He goes out to the back of the car, you know, to get the groceries. He opens the car, and let me back up just a little bit. What had happened was, at that time, there were some people going and passing out tracts into the cars. At that time, people would leave their windows down, and they would, they would, you know, leave it unlocked because you didn't have a fear of somebody taking things. So obviously somebody was out in the parking lot, working that parking lot, passing out tracts, and had the This Is Your Life. Well, anyway, the
kind of like today, if you'd put it under the windshield wiper, but that
day,
was normal.
Right. And so the next week had passed, and he went out to the grocery to get the groceries. He opened the door, and there was yet another This Was Your Life track.
Wow.
Obviously, somebody had was doing it again, going out. This time, it freaked him out totally, totally freaked him. And enough that he put it in his pocket, and he said, "This is from God. This is I need to read this again."
Wow.
So he brought the groceries in. He went to his back room, into his room, and he went back, and he read it, and he reread it. And he thought about it, and he reread it, and he put it in the top drawer, and he'd come back a couple of days or so later, and he'd reread it, and reread it. I'm not sure how many days it happened that he kept reading and reading, and it finally said, "I need to do this. I need to trust Christ as my Savior." So he went out to the backyard, and he knelt down, and he asked Jesus to come into his heart. And right away, he thought, "The Catholic Church didn't teach me this. I need to find the right church." And so about that time, either he had turned on the TV or whatever, and there was a 700 Club or something like that. And he thought, they would know. I'm going to call them. So he called them and said, "I just got saved, and I want to make sure that I go to a good church. Where should I go?" And they said, well, where did you go? And he said, I was in the Catholic Church. And they said, go back to the Catholic Church. And he said, I can't go back. They didn't teach me this. Mm-hmm. They lied to me. And so he was on a quest. He went to, I don't know how many different places he tried out, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, I mean, any type of church you could. He was trying to find, he was in a big search trying to find where can I grow? I want to find the right thing. I want to grow from here. About that time, he went to SEMO, Southeast Missouri State University, and he went there, and a friend of his had invited him to a tent revival from a Baptist church. And he decided to go. He thought he would dress up. He had a Levi Leiser suit back then. And he wanted to make sure people knew that he was saved, so he made sure he had a cross. A cross necklace, had a big cross, he said. And he said he unbuttoned his shirt down so you could see the cross and people would know that he was saved. And so he went to this this tent revival of this church, and it had the sawdust trail. They had the sawdust trail on there. And he went, and the preacher preached, the sermon was on, the bellows are burned. Of course, the last name is Beller, so he said it bothered him a little bit because it kept hearing the bellers are burned, and it bothered him, but not as much as the sermon that he was preaching, that if you're saved, that you need to trust, you need to share it with other people. Hmm. You need to pass that information on, and that was a burden to him. He wanted to start, he wanted to share the gospel. He didn't know what to do, but he wanted it, a deep burden. And long story, just of how that he started going to that church. The pastor directed him. He said, you could learn more by going up to a Bible college, a Baptist college in Indiana, House Anderson College. And that's where he went. He walked in, and he saw all these people with short haircuts. And he said he thought he was in a cult or something. He didn't know what to think. He walked in calling Job and Psalms Palms and so green. And he walked in and started to learn. We met there and we got married, and fast forward a little bit, he started pastoring in Arnold, Missouri, Arnold Baptist Tabernacle, and it had a burden. His burden continued. He wanted to serve the Lord, and he wanted to see folks saved. And he kept hearing that this has never been done. You can't reach people in St. Louis because of the brewery, because there's a curse. You can't do it. And that bothered him so much. And he thought, well, something had to be done. He would quote the verse, where sin doth abound, grace doth more abound. Mm. And something has to, did he just forsake St. Louis? Did he forsake the area? And he kept delving into it. And he would go to these archives and look and try to find some different, had anything been done? And he would go through the different things to look. And he compiled a bunch of information. And he decided, he came to me, and it was an encouragement to him that, yes, the Lord did do something. In fact, on the front of the book, The Soul of St. Louis, you have Gypsy Smith is in the corner here preaching 1909 in the St. Louis Coliseum. Wow. And you can see the thousands of people that are surrounding there, and how many lots of people were saved, and he put that on the front. But he had compiled all that he had done. He didn't do it to do it be an author. He didn't do it to try to get anybody to read anything. He did it for him. And he came to me and he said, I really think people could be blessed by this. I think I might want to put it in a book and let him read it and let it go.
Yeah.
So he did. He was a, you know, we decided to go ahead and do it. It was going to cost. I will say this, again, he was pastoring in Arnold, and he brought the, because it's costly to print books, very costly. Yes. And he had mentioned it to the church, and there was about four members that stepped up, and I would like just to mention them as a thank you. Mm-hmm. But they stepped up in a financial sense. It was Bob and Melanie Black, Linda and Terry Bonert, Pat DeLuback, and Ed and Michelle McCarter. And they helped financially. Obviously, we did the majority of it, but they did help. And when you go on a pastor's salary, you don't have much money.
Yeah.
And we were very, very grateful for what they did. So anyway, this did go to print. A lot of copies. I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 copies went out. And so, in fact, I think we had two churches that were started because of this book. We had a lot of people contact him about it. One person that got the book was a man named Jeff Faggart. who heads the Baptist History Preservation Society in Kannapolis, North Carolina. And he had called my husband. I was there when he got the call. And when he went to go get my husband answered the call, and he said, "Yes, this is Brother Beller." And he said, okay. He puts the phone down, cups the phone so that he can't hear, and he looks at me in a sarcastic way and says, "This guy does not know me, and he wants to pay for me to fly to Kannapolis to this Baptist history tour." He said, "Sure, this is really going to happen." And he was very sarcastic and, you know, like, "This isn't going to happen." And he picks up the phone. He says, "Sure, I'll go. Sure." Didn't think anything more about it. A week or so later, he gets an envelope from there and opens it up. And he said, "Oh, my soul." He sent the tickets. And he said, "I told him I would go. I guess I have to go."
Wow.
And so he ended up going on the Baptist history tour there. And he learned about our Baptist history, some, obviously not exhaustive at all. But he learned of some of our Baptist forefathers of Baptist history. And we went to a Baptist college. We didn't hear any Baptist history there. But this was something that he heard. And it touched his heart so much. One particular person that touched his heart was the grave of Edward Whiteman. Valentine Whiteman. And Valentine Whiteman was the grandson of Edward Whiteman, who Edward Whiteman was the last Baptist burned in Litchfield.
Whoa.
Litchfield, England. And Valentine Whiteman was his grandson. And he was the pastor, I believe, of his First Baptist Church in Groton. And he pastored for 42 years. By the way, his stone is a pulpit. It's about a regular-sized pulpit. And so he heard the story of Valentine Whiteman. And then after that, when he died, his son became pastor. And he pastored for 40 years. And then after that, his son pastored for 40 years. So that church had a Whiteman as a pastor for 120 years. And at the time, even though Brother Fager didn't know this, my husband was really discouraged because he just felt like he wasn't making a difference. He wasn't reaching people like he wanted to. And he felt like a failure. But when he heard that, and it really touched his heart, and he said, "If God wants me to stay, I'm going to stay." And he made that decision to stay in Arnold at the grave at Valentine Whiteman. And so the Lord began to touch his heart that even though he never started out to be an author, it wasn't anything that wasn't on his heart. He just wanted to be a pastor. The Lord kept putting on him really, really hard to write the Baptist history, a book on Baptist history. So he began to do a lot of research. And in order to understand your Baptist history, you first have to go to Europe and go forward. Why did we end up coming to America? What happened in Europe? So we did a couple different trips, about 4 weeks long, couple different trips to learn. He was very big about whenever he wrote a book, he wanted to make sure he got original sources and that everything was documented very, very well. All of his books are that way. They're extremely well documented. But we went to Europe, and we saw a lot of sites. We saw where Edward Whiteman was burned in Litchfield. So eerie to know. And there's a plaque there of that. We saw Zwingli in Zurich. We saw Zwingli's statue that not even a stone's throw away from that is the River Lamotte where Felix Mons was drowned because he baptized his converts. And that's just, it's right from feet away from the Zwingli statue. In fact, right over on the ground, you can see a small plaque stating of all the Baptist Christians that were drowned in that river.
That was referred to sarcastically as the third baptism.
Correct. Yes.
They had been baptized as infants, but if you're going to baptize them as adults, that will just hold you under a third time till you're done.
Right. Right. And then another, again, we saw many different sites in Europe, but another site that is important in our Baptist history was the Newgate Prison. And with the Newgate Prison, there was a prisoner, we call him the anonymous prisoner of Newgate Prison, And he wanted to try to find the Newgate prison. And he knew enough where it should be. And we were in London, England. And he's looking around trying to find this place. And he said, it should be right here. But, of course, all the buildings are there.
Yeah.
And we're walking. All of a sudden, we're walking. You hear this grate. We're walking across a grate on the ground. And we look down, and it looks like it's from the 17, 1800s, this grate on the ground. And he said, I wonder if this is the entrance to the Newgate prison. Well, it's right there is a tavern. So he decided, he said, we're going to have to go in and check. So we both walk into the tavern, and he said, we're looking for the Newgate prison. Do you know where it is? He said, oh, yeah, it's in our basement. So he said, just a minute, we'll take you down. So we go down, and down the stairs, pretty eerie, and we walk through, and we see this door. The door was actually open.
Wow.
And that's a very, very heavy door, extremely heavy door. And we walk in, and it's very dark in there. And inside the prison is, the only way to explain it is there's two rows, top and bottom, and about three or four cells on each one.
Mm.
There was the size of a washing machine or a washer or dryer.
No.
So if you were on the top one, you would have to crank, you know, the bottom one too. They weren't big. But then the top ones just had bars, so you didn't even have a floor.
Oh.
The bottom one, you had the floor. But we took some pictures and so forth, but we were able to see where that prisoner of Newgate, of the Newgate prison was. Obviously, they would pull him up to go to Smithfield, which is two blocks down, and that's where they burned a lot of the Baptists as well.
So these are Baptist preachers that are in this prison. And then they're being taken from, you were saying, let me catch it. You were saying this was washer and dryer sized jail cells?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We have video on it, and you'll be able to see what they look like. It was very, very sad. It was very eerie to look at. But when they go down to the Smithfield, about two blocks down, I know Anne of Askew was, I believe Joan of Kent, if I'm not mistaken, was killed there. And there's also a plaque there as well of the Baptist people that were persecuted there.
But, and they were persecuted because these were criminals who were robbing and stealing? Or what were they doing that drove such persecution?
Because that they would not bring their children to infant baptism, or, you know, they went against their religious beliefs were.
Wow.
So talking about the prisoner at Newgate prison, he wrote he was trying to send a petition to the king to just give us our freedom, just let us have our freedom, our religious freedom. And of course then you couldn't just write something and send it to him, so he took milk and wrote it on a piece of paper, because when it dry you wouldn't see anything, but when you put it over a flame it pops up, you can read it,
kind of like an invisible ink.
Right, exactly. And they put it in milk bottles, and they when the people came, they got it, and he got it out there, and that was typed up, and that was put into in Parliament. It was read into record, so that's why it's permanent. It was given to the king, but the king and Parliament dismissed it, but the common people did not dismiss it and began to take notice of what had happened. And the he wrote, what he wrote was called A Humble Supplication, and talking about to the king. Well, that was read into Parliament, and somebody who noticed that was Roger Williams, who wrote The Bloody Tenet of Persecution in defense of the anonymous prisoner. He was a Baptist preacher, if I didn't say that. And so you can see that The Bloody Tenet of Persecution has a lot of the same principles, and if you read Sacred Betrayal, you could read in detail more about this. But The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, written by Roger Williams, is in defense of the anonymous prisoner in Newgate about religious liberty. Right next to it, my husband put the Declaration of Independence that carries over the principles from the Bloody Tenant into the Declaration of Independence. And we can see that our history, our Baptist history, and our liberty had started back or from the anonymous prisoner.
So you're saying that when Thomas Jefferson's drafting the Declaration of Independence, that these concepts came from an unknown Baptist prisoner who was arguing that, you know, as people created by God, that we have rights that come from God, not government?
Correct, yes.
So all these events in Europe laid the foundation for the American freedoms that we take for granted and don't even think about.
Yes, yes. And moving in America, a lot of people don't know that it was against the law to, if you didn't bring your infant to baptism, that you could be, it was against the law not to bring your child to infant baptism. There was it's called Oath of Freeman, that in Salem, Massachusetts in 1637, the Oath of Freeman was such that they had to swear first to reject the dominance of England, which was good, but second, then they had to swear to the civil and religious matters. The religious matters meaning that they had to be a member of the Congregational Church, and to be a member of the Congregational Church, you had to bring your you had to be infant baptized or bring your children to infant baptism, and our forefathers didn't want that, you know, and so our Baptist people were banished. Back then, banished to wilderness was almost a death sentence. You know, they lost property. Their property was stolen. They were beaten. They were, you know, just had all sorts of things, killed in some instance, hanged, because they would not follow their about bringing their child to infant baptism and on baptism itself.
So following your conscience could end up being a death sentence.
Yes. Yes, in the book here on the hand of kind providence, he says, the results of this Euro-dominating civil governments were devastating. Homes were stolen, property taken, banishments were affected. There were beatings, imprisonments, whippings, and hangings, and a spectacle in crimson red. He also mentions that in the next 150 years, her towns would run crimson red in the American struggle to find her identity and shake off the consequences of the blood of the innocents. And so the book America in Crimson Red is America in Blood Red that our forefathers had suffered.
And this is a painful history to find out of. I mean, you know, we think that America is the place of freedom, that it's a beacon shining.
Yes.
But it was because of Christian patriots who loved their country but had a conscience duty to God to follow what they believed they understood from the Bible.
Yes.
But they made it possible that way we can worship freely today.
Yes. And they were willing to take stand for their faith. And so the last thing I was thinking of was John Gonneau and George Washington. Whenever he was writing American Crimson Red, it was a 5-year research from 1620 to 1905. One thing he really wanted to find, although he found a lot, was that he had heard that John Gonneau baptized George Washington.
George Washington, the president.
George Washington, the president, yes. And John Gonneau was a Baptist preacher, and he was actually George Washington's personal chaplain in the war, in the
really?
Revolutionary War. And George Washington was a member of the Congregational Church. He had a pew there, but he would actually slip out and he would go to John Gonneau's church and listen from outside, because George Washington, the Congregational Church, his pastor was a Tory who preached against the Revolutionary War. And so Washington would walk out or slip out and go listen. But there was information that Gonneau had baptized George Washington, and he really wanted to find it. And he looked hard, and he studied, and he went to archives, and he would go and study, look online, and call people, call archivists, and everybody would say, "Oh, we heard about that, but there's nothing out there." Went to George Washington's the church there, and they said, "There's nothing out there. It's just a myth. He never did that." And so he did so much research trying to find it. And he told me one day, he said, if it's going to be anywhere, it's going to be at the Rochester, New York Library. He said, let's go up there. He said, I don't know if it's there, and we're just gonna drive. And if it's not, we'll just keep going. So anytime we went to archives, we always had our little copier that we'd make copies. We had our computer. He would type if we couldn't make copies. Of course, we had to document where they came from and do all the proper things that way. But and we had our copier, one or two reams of paper, and he would go and get books and say, you know, make copies of 19 to 25 or 45 to 81 or whatever it was, and I'd, you know, document on them what I was doing. So we went there, and with our copier, with our computer, with a camera sometimes, we would take pictures, and he was such a student to go in and find. It was really good at finding information. So we walked in with all of our gear, walked in, talked to the archivist. Again, he asked about anything with George Washington's baptism, and she said, oh, no. And he said, okay. He said, I want you to do something for it, because this archive, you can't go back there.
Okay.
Such old documents.
Wow.
You know, it has to be them. So you really have to know what you're looking for, a certain book or whatever. So he said, okay, then do this. I want you to go back there, and I want you to look and see if there's something that you just forgot it was there, like underneath the shelf, like at the bottom, and it's going to have a lot of dust on it. And he said, look for something with a lot of dust, and you don't even know. He said it could have fallen behind books. He said, but look under or in the corner that you just forgot it was even there, and it's got tons of books. So she said, okay. And I'm looking at him like, what are you saying? And I didn't say that, but it just was like, okay. So we're starting to unload all of our gear, the copier. It was at 5, 6, 7 minutes tops. She walks out, white as a ghost, brings two boxes out. And she said, I don't know what this is. She said, but it was exactly like you were back there. And she said, I went back there, and it tons of dust. It was underneath a bunch of stuff at the bottom. And she walks up, and she puts it on the table. And she said, that's the weirdest thing. And she walks away. And they were opened this way. The boxes opened up this way. Oh, also, he had mentioned to her, he said, look for something with Lemire Barnes on it, because he had documented George Washington's baptism. And also, there were supposed to be affidavits of people that saw him be baptized. He opened up the box, and sure enough, there were all the affidavits of the people who were there, who documented, stating that George Washington was baptized by John Gonneau, and Lemire Barnes' book of the documentation as well. So he immediately went to the archivist and said, this is it. This is what's been lost. And you need to make sure this stays out now, and made sure of that. But it was such a blessing that he was able to find that, and it was documented. And our history's being lost. Our history, you know, we need to be careful to hold our history for our kids.
So why is it important if our history's being lost?
Well, you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, to destroy people, you must first sever their roots. And our roots are being severed, and our history is being severed. Our kids don't know about it. It's interesting to note that whenever Cornwallis, Washington won, Cornwallis surrendered to 8,000 troops. He did not want to attend the ceremony, the surrender ceremony.
Cornwallis
did not want to attend it.
Because this was a disgrace for a British officer.
It was. And it was something that the sword would be given to the general who won. That was typical that they did that as a sign of surrender, as a symbol of surrender.
Admitting he's the better man.
Right.
And a British officer wouldn't do that.
Right. So he did not attend that ceremony. But Lafayette later gave his sword to George Washington. Whenever George Washington was baptized by John Gonneau, later George Washington gave that Lafayette sword to John Gonneau. And you can see that sword is in the William Jim College in Liberty, Missouri. And there is a portrait a painting that was commissioned by the family of John Gonneau baptizing George Washington. And whenever George Washington was baptized, it broke the baptism of Europe.
Wow. So the sword of the British Empire that's presented as their symbol of defeat is in a Baptist school?
It's in a, William Jewell College So it's a blessing, and we need to keep our, let our kids know their heritage and know their history. So whenever the winds of whatever, persecution, whatever, that they have a good foundation and they remain strong.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today and telling us about our history. After a break, we're going to hear from your son about some of the more of these incredible stories of our heritage, of people who've sacrificed their lives, that we have the freedom to worship God according to His word and our conscience. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for joining us today for Our Christian Heritage. For more information, visit us online at christianheritage.info.